2 minutes after nine on what's this, the 31st. And present we have Senators Coghill and Geisel, and myself, Chair Dyson. Two out of the three of us have seen the presentation before, I believe, in Judiciary. I understand that Senator Stedman may still not be able to get in here because of air traffic, and I hope Senator Wilkowski will be with us soon. Commissioner, would you like to join us and perhaps introduce your staff that are here?
Good morning, everybody. Joe Schmidt, Department of Corrections Commissioner. With me is Deputy Commissioner Ron Taylor. Leslie Houston, Deputy Commissioner, is in the front row, and Casey Schroeder is with us as well, our ledge liaison.
I'm sorry, go back and have them raise their hands here.
Oh, I'm sorry, Leslie. Okay, Leslie, and our ledge liaison slash bodyguard.
Roger.
Casey, so.
Not knowing the skill level of these people, I would have picked Ron, but.
And when you know the skill level, you would pick Casey. No offense, Ron's a tough guy, but. Thank you all. We don't get many opportunities to get into a public forum like this and present, and I think it's valuable to us because we get to show what we think is the best way forward, the direction we're going. We're going to get to talk today a little bit about why we think we're doing well, what we're doing well, and then some areas we need to improve on. And then, of course, listening is the best part of the whole thing. The questions are always very telling, and then the response and the back and forth is kind of really what we're looking forward to, because that's very telling for us on which direction we should go with these various different complicated issues. We're in and we've said this a couple times before at other presentations, we're in kind of a grade and measure mode right now. In the last 5 or 6 years, we've done quite a bit of systemic changes with the department. The introduction of a program plan, vocational rehabilitation. We've upped the number of halfway house participants, electronic monitoring. We built a new prison, the Goose Creek, of course. And these are a lot of big systemic issues that need to be prove up now. And we want to run them. We want to make sure that our program plan, for instance, is doing what we thought it was going to do. We have national averages and evidence-based and numbers and things, but we want to make sure that here in Alaska they're working like what we build them, doing what we build them as they would do. And, you know, to that end, Ron and Leslie are both recently promoted to Deputy Commissioner. Sam and Carmen both retired within the last couple of months, and it gave me a chance to reshuffle the deck a little bit and take this, I won't say new direction, we've always been grading ourselves, but this is going to be a little bit more emphasis on grading. Ron is in charge of operations and all of Carmen's work with reentry and recidivism, and Leslie is in charge, as she has been, of the budget, the finances, medical, mental health, and then we've added to Leslie's duties the grading and audit structure, and she's in the process now of building different instruments, if you will, to look at our different pieces, the different pieces of our department. So that's going to be our focus. To replace Leslie as director, we promoted Kevin Worley. He used to be our internal auditor, so he's now the ASD for the department. So we kind of see we took that mindset and just kind of elevated it one notch so we can build that into our way forward. That doesn't mean no changes. Of course, we're going to, as we grade and audit, we're going to find things. And if it's a systemic thing, we're going to tackle it. It's not that we lost capacity to make systemic changes, but we'd like to just step back now and look and watch and report. So another piece, of course, of reporting, if something isn't working, that's just as important as the stuff that is working. Actually more important. And we'd rather stay ahead of it and tell the committees and tell the public, this is not working the way we thought. Here's what we want to do to fix it. And we found pretty good support when we approach it that way. Rather than being caught flat-footed, we didn't know this wasn't working. This isn't working for your community or for, you know, the district you're from. We'd rather try to stay ahead of it. So that's why we're...
Commissioner?
Yes, sir.
You can throttle a little back on the speed of your presentation. We're not...
Okay.
That time constrained.
Okay. We're going to talk about, of course, the mission of the department, some of our goals, and importantly, some of the trends that we're seeing in the inmate population, violent versus nonviolent, things like that. When I talk about the trends and what the population looks like as compared to what it looked like maybe 10 years ago, it always generates questions that I cannot answer. If we have a bigger number of a certain kind of offender, someone will say, well, why is that? Well, I try not to try to speculate or guess on why that is. I hope that I can just present where we are and then as a discussion point, if nothing more. Mr. Taylor is going to talk about some of our intervention strategies, some of our risk assessment work, a program overview, Goose Creek, of course, our PACE model, and a little bit about EM. I should say on electronic monitoring, we're putting together a more comprehensive presentation specifically on EM, some of the costs, some of the different technologies that are available. We don't have that all as of yet. Probably by next week we will. We'll be presenting some of that. We do have some base information on electronic monitoring, though, that we can talk about. Before I get to the mission statement, last year the Department of Corrections did 40,300 bookings. Now that doesn't mean 40,000 Alaskans came through our doors. 40,000 bookings was represented by 22,000 unique individuals. So that's 22,000 Alaskans that came in, obviously more than once. Almost 2,000 of those were what we call Title 47s, non-crims. Those are the inebriates on the street that might freeze to death if not for some type of shelter. And so I just think that's something that...
I didn't realize those folks were your jurisdiction.
They are primarily a health and social service issue.
Yes, sir.
When there is no place to stay warm, however, they will come to the jail. Some questions have come up over past presentations. Are they just treated like a criminal? And to some degree they are. We don't fingerprint them, but we photograph them. There's a booking process. We have to do all that. But we want to hold them for 12 hours in hopes that somebody will come get them. If not, they walk out the front door. I will tell you it's certainly not the best way, but it's the only thing available. It's about 2,000 a year is what we...
And if I may, and those come out of your budget?
They do. They do. At a hearing yesterday, Senator, we started to talk back and forth a little bit about that issue, and what we offered was, as a first step, I don't know the solution, and I don't want to say, well, call health and social because it's their problem. We're all in this together. What I offered was, for us with our new audit, regime that we're going to be entering here, is maybe put together the actual cost, how many there are, we know that now, where they are, when they are. It's probably temperature-based, to be honest with you, which is probably monthly-based, right? If we could dial some of that down, write a report from our data that's a little more specific, we would then know the cost. We'd know the cost by region. I'm pretty sure we could come up with all of that in a reasonable amount of time. And that might be the first step in talking through what the solution is. I mean, first we should know what the problem is and what the cost is, because any solution is going to have a cost. We should know what to compare that to, and we can provide that. So that's kind of where the discussion stands with us right now. So,
and I've ridden with a community service patrol, and when they're freighting people down to Brother Francis shelter, and some of those folks, they have to do a medical evaluation. They don't know if they're in a diabetic coma, overdoses, whatever else. Does that happen with many of those folks that you pick up that way or come to yours?
Senator, it's an interesting question. We do a medical screening, so we're pretty good about not having them expire in our jail. Again, they're only there for 12 hours. The nurse has to screen them, to make sure. Some of the alcohol levels, however, will frankly blow your mind. Numbers that you would think a person couldn't even function. Some of these folks will come in blowing maybe a 4, a point. I mean, it's just...
Okay, thank you.
So.
One question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of the Title 47, is that 2,000 unique individuals?
Oh, that's 1,800 admissions, and it's that number is not going to be unique individuals. That's something else we probably have to pull.
Because with the Community Service Patrol, for example, in Fairbanks, they have people that are what they call frequent flyers.
Yes.
They are continually picked up. And it looks to me like in the Fairbanks area anyway, they are trying to get them into places other than jail for the kind of the short-term safety of that individual.
Mm-hmm.
Is that do you see that as part of the solution to this particular issue?
I'll turn through the chair to Senator Coghill, like an alternative housing arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. If that existed, then we wouldn't have them in our jail.
And as I understood, you're a spillover on Brother Francis, or
we are.
You take the excess.
Yeah, we are. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes, if we're full and we can't take the Title 47, sometimes, and I'd have to look into tell you how often this still happens, but I know as working in the facilities, sometimes the person is criminally charged with something. Now, on one hand, that's a very bad practice. On the other hand, it's the only safe thing we can do. The jail's full. We say we don't have any holding space for this guy for 12 hours. He's really not our purview. Take him somewhere else. There is nowhere else. He comes back with some type of public disorder charge. Now he's one of our prisoners. We take him. And then there's a court cost. And so as we're thinking about that would be another cost we would have to factor into our study is how much criminal activity wouldn't happen if the capacity was there.
So just one more question on that. Sure. I know you work with the Department of Health and Social Services on this. What is the venue with which you work with them? I know you have like a criminal working group on some issues. What is the venue with health?
Yes, sir. Through the chair to Senator Coghill, my answer would be exactly that. Mr. Taylor might be able to fill in. Is there a blank you could fill in, Ron, on that, how we work with HS&S on?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, we also work with them in small work groups through the trust, because the trust has also taken on this as one of their projects as well. So
that would be the Mental Health Trust Authority.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please continue. Sure. Just under 6,000 prisoners in our secure facilities, halfway houses, and electronic monitoring as of the end of last year, and just over about 6,100 on probation and parole. So that's our mission statement. We've said this before, three parts: secure confinement, reformative program, supervisory entry. Obviously, enhancing the safety of our communities is always the first thing. And when we talk about some of the halfway house placements and those things, we try to be as careful as we can on who's qualifying to get out there and making sure our classification system is putting people appropriately. So we wanted to be more than the mission statement we came from was secure, was incarcerate and supervise, which is part of what we do. But we saw that pretty quickly as only a part of what we do. You might even say a small part of what we do. Protecting the public, locking people up is one way to do it. It's the most secure way to do it, and it's also by far the most expensive way to do it. So we're always looking for other cheaper ways. Never putting someone we believe too dangerous for something because we're out of room or because it's less expensive. We'll bite the bullet and spend the money for people that we believe are dangerous. But as Mr. Taylor's going to talk about, our classification system's been revised. We found when we compared ourselves against national averages, we tended to overclassify people that we were calling close custody, which is just under max. Other systems may call high minimums or medium custody. And so we renovated our system and we
Senator Coghill.
I heard the discussion earlier on classification. But what I didn't ask is the criteria or the way you classify and how you found that you were overclassifying.
Okay. We, through the chair to Senator Coghill, Ron's the best one to speak to how we, you know, the matrix we use or the process we use today. I know this is a little bit before Ron's time. Early on in my time as commissioner is when we started to look at that. Goose Creek was going to come, and it was at the time a 2,250 bed max custody, you know, mega prison it was being called, and we wanted to make sure we really needed that. And so classification of our prisoners is one of the first things we looked at. We had a consultant come up and work with us on the system, and there's national averages published that we compared ourselves against carefully. We're a unified system. There's only six states that are unified, meaning we handle all the misdemeanors, the felons with less than a year, unsentenced people, everybody in our state system. So if the state of Arkansas, who their corrections, their DOC will do sentence felons with more than a year. So that's apples and oranges compared to our population, right? When we do 40,000 bookings, that's everybody, you know. So anyways, Mr. Taylor, is there anything you want to add to the classification? How we determine who is what?
In terms of the categories, through the chair, Senator Coghill, were you interested in that as well?
Mr. Chairman, what I'm asking is, first of all, there obviously was a look at the classification and how you were overclassifying in certain areas. There must have been a resetting of the criteria. So obviously there was a consultant. So just give me a general idea. You don't have to go into all the specifics. Just a general idea how you reset that classification.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, the actual categories for the classification didn't change. It was still minimum, medium, close, and max. What really changed is who was actually going in each of those classifications. And so we saw that we were putting more. Since we're risk adverse, we're putting more of our persons in higher custody or higher level of custody, when really we should have been bumping them down somewhat to medium. So some ended up even being in a minimum classification.
So I guess my question, Mr. Chairman, is, was that based on interview, flight risk, risk to the general population?
Through the chair, in terms of medium or close custody,
yes.
the schedule was based on that. Our classification was based on, for our max, those who had been a flight risk or assaultive behavior, and our close custody was ones where we could manage them in general population, but there were some restrictions placed on them. And medium, there were no real restrictions, but they needed to be in general population.
That's fine with me, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and I think for both of you, you're using the word general population, not the public, but the general population in the facility.
Through the chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, and I assume you must have some way of isolating some of the prisoners or your guests who are perhaps at danger from other inmates.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, max custody would be the ones that are, you know, seriously hurt another prisoner, assaultive to staff, anything like that, escape risk, anything along those lines. We've got about 70 statewide out of 6,000 prisoners, however, only about 70 score max custody. Yes,
that was not my question. I'm talking about protecting particularly vulnerable prisoners from assault by other prisoners.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, we use administrative segregation for that. Sometimes we can do it in a housing unit. We've developed some different types of housing units. We're developing a gang housing unit right now. It's very restrictive, but if we suspect that you're involved in a gang, we have a place to put you. We're building that in Seward so we can do some further evaluation. We housing by custody. Sometimes there's rape allegations. Very problematic for our system because we don't have the luxury of giving everybody their own room. And so one of the first things we did along the lines of classification was a housing by custody protocol where a light, medium, or minimum won't live with a heavy, medium, or close. We try our best to keep them predators with predators and more of a prey with prey. Predators will prey on each other. I mean, you know, we can't stop it, but we certainly we don't do everything for liability, but we certainly, you know, look better when there's an allegation or a problem. If we don't have a 99-year murderer living in a cell with a first-time DWI, and that's an extreme example, but that's the kind of.
And I hear just anecdotally that often child molesters have a hard time in the general population.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chairman, they do. Sometimes they're expected to pay protection and
least
carried upon. Sure. goals: protect the public, reduce recidivism. I've got a slide coming in just a second that talks about how many beds we have versus how many prisoners we have. Delay the need for construction of a new prison. Honestly, from my perspective, as I go through this process of building a prison and introducing a program plan, we've done both. We've done the secure piece, we've done the program piece, and we're working very hard on the reentry piece. Judging by the reaction of the legislature, of the public, of different places we go to speak and listen, Alaskans are not real happy to build expensive new prisons. I mean, it's a big cost. It's not a popular cost, and yet as we introduced a program plan, we feel very supported by that. There's been some hard questions, there's been some criticism, but nothing like the cost of constructing a new prison. So as my job to try to figure out how to best serve the public, I gained a direction that we should do everything we can to put a new prison off as far as we possibly can.
And as I said before, Senator Coghill and I have sat through something like this presentation before, but Senator Geisel hasn't, and I think a very important thing for you to rehearse for her is the impact of the new prison, what the impact of bringing all the our out-of-state folks back from now Colorado, and then, as I remember your previous discussion, if we continue growing the prison population we are, that some like 7 or 9 years out, Goose Creek will be full, and we will face these same hard decisions on another one. Anyways,
sure.
For all
sure.
This part of the discussion, I'd like you to bore down on any parts of it that are particularly interesting to you or you want to know about, Senator Geisel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Should I just overview quickly Goose Creek? When we talked about out-of-state versus in-state, There's a couple things that were a little bit problematic for us. One thing, I never wanted to go out and say, look at the jobs we're going to create. I think our job is to make less jobs in our business. We should do everything we can to get smaller, not bigger, or at least not grow as fast as we have been. And the argument to bring the prisoners home to be close is not a popular one. It's an expensive one. And so those two things worked against us. What we did talk about, though, and ultimately gained support for, was when the prisoners come home, it's really not about the prisoner. When they can stay in touch with those that are going to help them, maybe for free, when they get out, a place to live, whatever it might be, some support, we should take full advantage of that. And it's much less likely to happen when they're in another state, when people have to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars to go and see them. We did as much as we could with video visitation to try to keep people connected, but it's nothing like being at home. Another thing that we ran into was transports are expensive. They're close to $200,000 to run a plane back and forth. 110 prisoners can move each way for somewhere between $100,000 and $250,000, depending on when we're doing it and how much lead time we have. We might have people be behaving themselves, going to program, working themselves down through our new classification system, getting into minimum custody, qualifying for a halfway house, qualifying for electronic monitoring, and they're $100,000 away. So we have to wait until the next transport comes. That might be a quarter of a year or half a year, depending. So we end up with not the end of the world, but we're not nearly as efficient as we could be. Again, I can't parlay that into look how cheap it'll be if we come home, but it is one of those things. It has an expense, and it also has a people expense, because the people are not getting through our system the way they should, not getting the support when they get out, you know, to not to reoffend. It was an interesting opportunity. It was a good opportunity for us to kind of take a max custody mega prison apart at the beginning before a hole was dug. And we could start over again with what we thought our population accurately is, how many mediums we have, how many closes we have, and the fact that 95% get out of jail. We've got to pay attention to that. So we've got about 40,000 square feet in that facility of program area, vocational rehabilitation. Ron's going to talk in a little bit about some of the numbers of folks that were running through our vocational programs. And the programs that we build are hopefully relevant. Net making rural Alaska, small engine repair. There's a whole litany that Ron's going to talk about, but we tried to keep them in something that a person could actually use when they get out of jail. A lot of culinary, you know, that's a very popular one. So in a nutshell, that's why a lot of people talked about how many jobs is going to create. Well, 350, but that really wasn't our selling point on this. Our selling point was trying to do a better job with recidivism reduction. So am I close, Senator, to what you're looking for? Okay. Great.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Collier.
I do know that it requires several new officers. And so as you went into the training, how was your recruitment, filled out the positions? Were they other jails drawn from? Was there a tension between jails? Gotcha. How did that shake out?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, very relevant question. We did a lot of work there. We've pushed our recruitment system harder than it's ever been pushed, and I'm happy to say we've hired more people than we've ever hired in any fiscal year before. We're up over 100, and we're about 30 behind where we wanted to be right now. But what we did, we kept Goose Creek exactly where we said all along, and it's at or above the number of prisoners we thought we would have right now. About 450 are in there right now. The first thing we did is we allowed as much experience as we possibly could. We didn't have to waive the transfer policy, but we wanted everybody that wanted to go there to go there with as much experience as we could bring. We ended up with about a third of our security staff transferred with experience, which is fantastic. When we opened Seward, I was there when we opened Seward, and we didn't have that luxury, so we had a lot of learning to do real quick. And we were learning against people who had done more time, for instance, than I had been alive at the time. So that's always an interesting dynamic. I've been in jail since 63. And I've only been around since 65. That was, and I'm going to tell him to clean his room. And anyways, so we were very fortunate there. We have not yet refilled those 30 positions in Seward. What we did instead, because we've got the beds right now as we're coming back home, is we refurbished House 3, basically closed it, because there's 30 positions involved with each housing unit. So we just closed one of them. We painted everything, baseboards, all that kind of stuff. We're moving now to the next housing unit. We're going to use this bit of time to refurbish Seward. And then as soon as Goose Creek is up to where we're comfortable and we can take a break for a minute, we'll focus on Seward. And, of course, Seward, living arrangements are an issue there. We'll have to address some things. But we're not quite where we wanted to be recruitment-wise. We're doing very, very well. And we're managing the shortage, I think, the best we can, and we really do not have any kind of a security problem because of it. So Yes, sir.
Commissioner, give us a rough idea of how much, let's say, the average correction officer makes in salary, and then what that figure is with overhead and burden. Overhead and burden, administrative costs, you know.
Oh, okay, Mr. I'm not sure I understand the wage of the correctional officer.
Yeah.
Even and what percentage that is of the total, or?
No. I want you to say the average correction officer, you know, been there 5 years, makes $78,000 a year.
Okay.
And overhead and burden is another 40%, or whatever
total,
those
total cost to the state, I understand. Could I have Leslie Houston answer that for me?
Sure. And at appropriate time here this morning, whatever.
Oh, just, okay, sure, sure. The, am I ready to, okay, cool, thank you. Did we do goals? Okay, well, let me hit one more goal. Ensure that incarcerated offenders spend their time in custody productively. And just one little point that I try to make with that is your reentry, since we know that 95% get out in their lifetime, 50% are getting out in the next 6 months. Our turnover is incredible. Not to worry, we'll have another 50% behind them. We'll still be where we are. But they're getting out so fast, and so many are getting out. Reentry, your reentry should start the day you walk in, not the day you walk out, like it historically has been. Your behavior in the facility, what we expect you to be engaged in, the way we expect you to act like a normal person on the street, all that. This shouldn't be viewed as this is jail time now, and then when you're done with this, you can go back to being a regular Alaskan. You're an Alaskan here that owes something right now, and you need to spend every single day for the day you walk out and getting ready for it. And sometimes it'll be shocking. Someone gets close to the end of their sentence, might be a lengthy sentence. Where are you going to stay? With my mom. When was the last time you talked to your mom? Can't remember. So those kinds of things, we all should be thinking that. So on the recidivism rate, this slide is from November of 2006. And I say that because it was published and put on my desk January of 07. And the reason I bring this is because it was our roadmap, and there's a lot of detail in the report, but the purpose of this slide is to show, A, 66% of the people come back to jail if we're not doing anything, or if they're not doing anything. But more significantly, look at the curve. 34% come back in the first 6 months of release. The next 6 months, that percentage goes in half. And then look what it does. It goes in a quarter after that. So what that tells us is, as we work on reentry, the first 6 months is critical. If and that doesn't mean we have to give them everything for 6 months, but if we focus on that 6 months, and when Ron's talking to me, he'll talk about some of the things we're doing, housing, sober support, employment. Those are the three. That doesn't guarantee anything, but without any of those three, the chances of being one of those 34% is huge, right? So that's what we gleaned from that. Not only my first reaction is, 66%, full jails, expensive jails. Don't want to advocate less laws or anything. I don't want to say that the public was wrong in various things that are illegal. I don't think that's my purview, but people coming back over and over again should be our purview. That's secondary prevention.
Sort of for the record, several of us are working on how do those folks who keep serving their terms serially and coming back, how do we sort out those who are coming back because of a technical violation of the terms of probation? They miss an appointment, have a dirty UI, you know, whatever, but there's no harm.
You know, yes, sir.
And so on. How do we do what is within our purview to not having people come back for whom it's inappropriate?
Agreed, Mr. Chairman.
How would we do that?
If I could say, when we build a program plan, who we put in the program is really not nearly as important. It sounds crazy, but it's not nearly as important, I don't think, as who we don't put in the program. We operate with kind of a rule of thirds. Our mental health folks have worked with me on this early on. About a third of our population is going to reoffend again, and you could spend $1 billion on program, and they're going to come back. Some of the younger offenders with multiple violent, you know, that doesn't mean there's no hope for them, but that's a good example of somebody who's going to come back. You don't want to infect your program with that guy. He might be a psychopath, a very good salesperson, very charismatic, very smart, very good at learning your vernacular and then using it to better his own situation. So you want to try to carefully find those people and don't infect your program with them. There's another third, of course, on the bottom, maybe a 45-year-old male who was a DWI or something like that, probably not going to come back. As much as I'd like to put a bunch of those guys in our programs and say, look, legislature, look how good our programs are doing. They were going to do fine without the program. Don't infect them with your program. It's that third in the middle, you know. So it's that third in the middle that are amenable to change, not real bad, not real good, in the middle. Our PACE model that Mr. Taylor's going to talk about, however, this is a out-of-custody piece. What do you do with somebody who's the incorrigible? You're not going to waste your program on him.
Please, we don't speak an acronym well.
Oh, PACE?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Probation Enforcement, Probation Accountability Certain Enforcement. It was built from the HOPE, Hawaiian Offender Probation Enforcement model. Judge Alm built that model in Hawaii. And what it does is it takes a probationer who misses an appointment. This is completely contrary, Senator, to what you just said a second ago, but you miss an appointment, you go to jail. We have an agreement with the courts and the police agencies that the people that are put on this program by us, they didn't volunteer for it, they're our worst, they're going to reoffend. They're the people that are the highest risk that we have. You miss an appointment, you're late for an appointment, you hot UA, you miss UA, you go to jail. The judge will see you in 24 hours, so we don't get into this 30-day thing where they never get out, you know, get back out. And we put 30 people on the program, and within a week, 17 of them were in jail. Now, what I said to that was, you know what, good, because they were probably coming back to jail anyway, and B, we got the right ones. These are the high-risk people. That means we've properly identified the highest-risk people. 3 weeks after that, we weren't even having hearings, because they knew certainty of getting caught. They wanted to see if we were serious about it. Are the cops really going to come get me, and you know, because I didn't go to an appointment? Well, they did. Is the judge really going to see me in 24 hours? Yep, and they did. Very, very effective. It's up, what are we at now? About, are we at 70 in Anchorage? About 70 in Anchorage. We're starting one for domestic violence offenders in Fairbanks, and we found it's a smaller program, but very, very good results. So that's an example of a program where we didn't focus on the amenable middle. We focused on the worst ones that were going to reoffend, but that's a more of a containment situation. And actually, it had very, very good results. So we're very pleased with that. So the population, and you know, like I said, a couple of folks here have seen this a couple of times, but I like to present this, and probably next year too, as we move along, the line that starts off on the bottom is how many beds we have, and the line on top is how many prisoners we have. And you can see when Goose Creek opens, those lines cross. We finally, for the first time in a long time, have more beds than prisoners. Not for very long, unfortunately, because the lines cross again about 2016. The purpose of this, though, I'm kind of a visual guy. It's the picture. If the blue line, if we curb recidivism, it wouldn't take very much to tilt that blue line down, and just a little bit of a reduction there, you can see how that cross point would move way out. I mean, years. There's a possibility here if we act and we continue to, I believe, do what we're doing, and we're successful with it. And that's the point in which we have to start talking about a new prison that I'm trying to push away as far as I possibly can. And so that's the significance of that one. A trend towards nonviolent. Back 10 years ago, as you can see, 42% of our population was nonviolent. Today, or as of the end of last year, 62%. That doesn't mean we have less violent, but they're not growing at the, you know, the violent is not keeping pace with the overall growth. We're trending towards nonviolent. One thing on the other side of that discussion is sex offenders. Sex offenders actually are considered violent, and we have a full percentage more this year in custody than we have since the years that I've been watching this data. We've always been very close to 13% of our population is sex offenders. We're very close to 14% this year. That offender profile will be coming out soon. The sentence length for sex offenders in the last decade has doubled. And I don't have data to tell you the last half of the decade or the first half of the decade, but it's in the last decade. They've almost doubled. And one of the things of significance is the number of sex offenders that we're releasing. One of our measures in our department is to increase the number of polygraph exams on the sex offenders when they release. And we're down this year, a couple. And we're obviously troubled by that. When we looked at what's happening, in FY08, the department released 137 sex offenders to be processed. Last year we released 55. So what it's looking like is they're staying in longer sentences, more in jail, and less are getting out. So again, not to critique that or...
Senator Giesel.
Thanks. Commissioner Schmidt, I want to focus on a different category of nonviolent offenders. At least I think that this group will fall into it. And that's prescription drug abusers. Can you parse out that population from your data?
Let me turn and look at Leslie for a nod. Yes or no? No. what I've heard in the, through the chair to Senator Geisel, apologize, it's the mics or whatever the charge is will encompass all of that, and I don't think we have the ability to pick it apart without going through each file. Law might be able to, the courts might be able to. We'd be happy to work with them. I mean, we're also interested in that data, but I don't, just from what we have available, it doesn't look like it's
okay. Thank you.
Sure. The length of stay, the people that are doing 37 months or more, 10 years ago was less than 7%, and now it's 18.5%. So you could say that that one almost tripled. So the group that it came from, when you look back at 02, we had about a little less than 7% doing more than 3 years or more than 37 months. The group of 7 to 12 months was 21%, and now that group is only 11.5%. So it looks like folks that were getting 10 years ago, a little less than a year, are now getting more than three. Again, just what the picture looks like today.
It would be interesting, and it's beyond your purview, but to track how that has related to our putting presumptive sentences on folks and removing some judicial discretion. It would be interesting to plot those against each other, but perhaps we can get Department of Law to give us some figures on that.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Sure. If it's okay with the committee, this is where Ron usually takes the intervention strategies.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you to Mr. Chair and the committee members for having us here this morning. So, in response to the high recidivism rate that the Commissioner found when he came in, what did the department do overall? The Commissioner talked about how we changed our philosophy, and if you look on page 8 at our the slide above, you'll see that the philosophy actually changed to one of risk, need, and responsivity. This has been different from what we were using in the past, which was simply a risk and control. We identified your risk. We're going to control you based on that risk level. Now we need based on research and based on evidence-based practices, to change our philosophy and change the way that we actually look at our cases and respond. So the risk principle, it's the who. Who should we be targeting? We should be targeting those moderate and high-risk cases and doing more of our motivational interviewing to be able to get them ready to reenter into society. Our need principle is what factors that have really caused or brought these persons into our care or into our custody, and is there a way that we can not only identify those factors, but going to the next response, which is responsivity, how do we actually respond to them? In other words, how do we provide programming, resources, the appropriate referrals, and how do we supervise based on that risk and that need principle, and then tailor our conditions, tailor the way that we handle our violations to match that risk and need level. Because we know that if we were able to address the risk and needs appropriately and to respond with the appropriate amount of supervision efforts, what we're going to find is their likelihood of returning to custody goes down dramatically. So our focus is going to be on really behavior change overall. We're moving from custody and monitoring to behavior change, from agency isolation, not thinking that we're the only one invested or the only one responsible for reducing recidivism, to more collaboration, reaching out to our partners, looking to go from unproven methods to using what works, measuring outcomes instead of looking at our inputs that we used to report on, and then focusing on offender success to improve public safety rather than contributing or focusing on offender failure. So how do we assess risk? The Commissioner talked a few minutes ago about the classification policies, how they've been changed and updated so that, one, not only are we doing a better job of identifying the true risk level of a person when they come in custody, but we're also doing it in a much faster pace. So within 5 days, we're doing that classification so that we can get persons into the appropriate venue so that they could either serve their sentence, be involved in programming or treatment, or the necessary resources that they need. With that, what...
Excuse me, Ron.
No problem, sir.
Several places in the country, they've, you know, working on this real concept of restorative justice. And a part of that is enabling the perpetrator to do what they can financially or otherwise to try to return the victim to a pre-offense condition. But the second piece of that is to try to restore relationships. You know, that's victim-perpetrator relationships. And I suspect a significant part of that's beyond your purview. But is there anything active within your kingdom on either end of those two sections?
You know, I think we tried to do that in the past, and when several administrations ago, I believe, was when we were trying the restorative justice principle, we sort of moved beyond that more to where we are now, which most of the focus across the country have also moved into this direction of risk, need, and responsivity. I know that we have a victim impact class in some of our facilities. Whether or not we're pushing it to the length of the restoration piece, I'm not exactly sure, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure you're not, and I think it would be very difficult, you know, take time and resource and so on. And years ago, I put, you know, most of the pieces that are in our law for the restorative justice, just for instance, if the perpetrator has assets that are forfeit, the victim gets the money before the judge and the court system does, and you know, and so on and so forth. That's out of your purview. Anyways, those things I think are an ideal to shoot for, and you know, a few years around, my successors may ask you about, you know, what if anything you're doing, what if anything should you be doing. Please continue.
Thank you, sir. We've also changed or developed an offender management plan, which has actually become the roadmap in custody for what the offender is going to complete, whether it's required substance abuse or anger management or some sort of programming or resources to address their needs. And this also becomes a great foundation for transferring that person to supervision, so that once that they're out on probation and parole, we can literally pick up that roadmap and continue, rather than repeating some of the programs or resources that the person has completed while in custody. The Probation and Parole Division has also received some technical assistance from the National Institute of Corrections, and part of our response to receiving this technical assistance was to, again, look at our risk assessment tools and make sure that we were classifying or categorizing our persons in the right way. And I'll talk about that here in a second. You see the custody risk level on page 11. This is what the commissioner was talking about much earlier in terms of how we've moved more to national standards with our minimum, medium, close, and max. And then on the next slide, we're talking about our probation and parole risk levels, how we've actually moved from a three-tiered system, minimum, medium, and maximum, and are currently in the process of implementing a five-tiered system, which would give us some more flexibility in terms of how we're supervising our cases and being able to target our resources to the ones who, one, are ready to receive services, and then, two, more than likely able to complete what they're needing to complete for success.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
One of the things that I became aware of in an earlier part of my life was the programmatic approach, even under these risk levels, is hugely impacted by movement of population. So because of pretrial cases and having to move people from one facility to another. Is that still an issue? Did Goose Creek kind of balance that out? Because it's probably very frustrating to somebody who wants to get into a program and because of population movement gets kind of forced out of it.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, you're right. That has been a challenge of our system in terms of population management. And I know we'll be speaking more to that here in the next couple of weeks. But Goose Creek will take the pressure off of that. We'll raise quite a bit of programming resources that we will be able to put out at Goose Creek, and that will be for a big chunk of our medium population. So what, now that we've dealt with the risk principle, what's the need? And in looking at the need on page 13, you're looking at the criminogenic factors. These are those factors in research that have been shown must be addressed if we want to have any success in terms of stopping our probationers, parolees, and inmates from reoffending. So one of the things that we're looking at is their antisocial values and beliefs. We're looking at the way that our probationers, parolees, and inmates think, the people that they're hanging out with, their antisocial companions. We're looking internally at them, at their antisocial personalities and temperaments, to see whether or not they need self-management, problem-solving skills, or that we can help them with anger management. We have persons who are coming in with family or marital issues that we're doing a better job of helping them to rebuild those positive relationships, I think that Mr. Chair, you were talking about earlier, and helping them to do a better job of communicating. Substance abuse, as we know, in our state is huge. And so finding ways to, one, reduce the usage, but also to make sure that there's some support for that person outside of the treatment that they go through in form of aftercare and community care. Looking at employment skills, being able to rebuild those skills or actually give people skills that they haven't had in the past. Encouraging more education rewards. And looking at the leisure and recreation to see what people are doing in their downtime to make sure that they're being productive in their downtime rather than just hanging out.
Senator Geisel and then Senator Coghill.
So looking at that first bullet, substance abuse, there must be a detoxification program?
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, through DOC a detox program? Not necessarily a detox program in the institution. The commissioner talked about how we do the medical screening and we're watching as part of that medical screening process, but not in the sense of a true detox program that we would have out in the community.
Follow up, please. So if we have, if you incarcerate a heroin addict, there's clearly a process there in which their system clears of that drug. Same is true of cocaine. I'm thinking even of prescription pain medications. How is that managed?
Through the chair, again, that's through the medical screening process that I would not have enough information on.
So they would be put in another facility versus a prison. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Not necessarily, no. Okay. Through the chair.
Okay.
Senator,
all right.
But that raises a good question, and that is, how do you manage and support the person as they're going through the detox? Mm-hmm. We all assume that not many of them are getting drugs within this session. So I think that's the questions, or part of it that Senator Geisel was trying to get at.
Mr. Chairman, and through the chair to Senator Geisel, Mr. Taylor's right. It's the medical, more than medical screening. Medical screening is our initial. You know, are they safe tonight? Our medical and mental health staff will monitor, but it's not as comprehensive as what the Mr. Chairman was talking about. It's more of a how do they physically get through this. Leslie would be a good one, probably. I don't know, I'm going to put her on the spot, but being in charge of the medical folks, she could better explain probably how we, what we do. Mike Mott, our mental health unit, sometimes is utilized for such things, but I couldn't tell you the criteria sitting here, but I know that our medical staff are the ones that are involved in that. We don't have, Ron's programs are, you know, like an alcohol program, we do not have such a thing. He's absolutely right. What do we do with them? A medical maintenance, a medical oversight until they get through it. You know, obviously, if I'm assuming the courts might have other options than jail for some people that are in a real bad way. I don't know. I don't know what's available out there or how much they use. I'd have to look into that and find out. But
Senator Coghill.
So just on your criminogenic factors, this is an assessment, so you're assessing yourself kind of continually. So is it connected then to a outreach program into the prison population based on the categories that you've described?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's correct, and we'll be talking about some of those programs here in a few minutes.
Then, so the question comes to mind, are we providing, you know, like entertainment that pushes against that type of a thing? So I'm just curious how you guys see that. You know, I personally haven't been in jail, so I don't know what kind of internet access you have, what kind of TV you have, what kind of other entertainment issues that may push against the very things that you're looking at here. So I'm just asking for a scope.
Sure. Through the chair, per the name of the law just escaped me right when it shouldn't have. The prisoner
Raven
in the 90s. They can't have a television set unless they're working or getting a GED. And I'll think of the name and it'll be too late. But okay. it just ran out of my head. But so the televisions are there. We're eliminating those Xboxes. Machines and a lot of that was cheap entertainment, but as they come back from Colorado, we're going to get rid of all those. There's some internet capabilities that we're a little afraid of, that those machines are becoming quite complex now, and we can't really keep up with what they're doing, plus the, you know, some of the games and such are pretty violent, but we're hinging our decision on the internet capabilities and some of the clandestine things they can do with that technology, rather than getting into the whole, we don't, you know, what level of game can they have and what level of game can they not have. Technology is an interesting, you know, internet access is none. Now, if you want a GED, there's the way we're very soon going to be, it has to be an internet protocol, an internet test. So there's going to have to be some supervised internet action as time goes on pretty soon. Email is not something that I've been willing to address yet, but other places are successfully. And I tell you, we're projecting about 500,000 pieces of mail every year coming and going out of Goose Creek. And if there was some type of technology where it was safe and you could do email, not only could our machines scan those emails and not have a person reading or scanning or getting into all that, are you reading somebody's mail? You know, we could program in certain things to look for, phrases, words, and those kinds of things. So we could do a much better job of scanning it. And we don't have all this mail coming in that could be housed all kinds of things. LSD under the stamp. I mean, just little things that happen that are very, very hard to detect. So completely not what you asked, and I know I shouldn't do that, but it got me thinking about technology. We're kind of going that way, and I think we're going to be there one time. I wanted to get Goose Creek functioning, everybody confident, working good, and then start talking about some of that technology, because there's you have to pay staff to go through that mail, and there's a lot of it, and we don't get everything that comes. I mean, we're not going to catch everything. We're human beings. So anyway,
a few years back we have made an arrangement where your guests can make court appearances under some circumstances by a video conferencing link or something, which has solved some of your transportation issues and so on. At Highland Mountain, which used to be in my district and yours, you got three things going on there that are low cost. They've just started a jogging club, you know, and I understand a marvelous band.
Yep.
And they have been doing something with dogs, dog training, or, you know, and so on and so forth. And those are going to be pretty low cost, but I understand they're doing significant things for the morale of your guests there. Looking forward here, I don't see another piece here about the medical stuff. And is that Leslie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me ask her a couple of questions here.
Sure.
Just
sure.
In the meantime, because I don't want to lose them.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Leslie Houston, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Corrections.
Yeah, thank you. A couple of my acquaintances who have been your guests said they got the best medical treatment that they'd had in their whole life. You know, something must be going right, at least for a few folks. I asked the question in our last hearing, what are you getting for Medicaid, Medicare reimbursement for the treatment you're providing? And at that time, you weren't clear. Have you learned anything more about that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We've learned a great deal about it. And at this current time, there is no Medicaid or Medicare available to incarcerated individuals. and that it was under a federal code of regulations. In January of 2014, we will be able to, if through health care reform, if we should choose to participate, be able to collect some of the 50% reimbursements via Medicaid, Medicare, and that would be for eligible inmates, and it would, you know, reimburse for those services that we have to seek outside, say if they have to have an overnight stay in a hospital.
Yeah, thank you. And I understand that particularly with some of your older population, where people have had very bad behavior, that you have quite a few folks who have pretty complex medical issues.
Yes, Mr.
Explain
Chairman,
that, to
that
us
is
a little
correct.
Bit. How in the world do you meet those needs, some of which are quite complex?
Correct, and the way that we do meet those needs right now is through traditional health care, and it is costing, you know, general fund dollars. It's 100% general fund at this point in time, and it is very costly. We never know what we're going to get, you know, with an offender that walks through the door. Sometimes we get someone in late stage 4 cancer that we have to maintain the treatments, and it's very, very costly. Now, if they're eligible, and it's the same eligibility criteria for any Alaskan or as it is for an inmate for Medicaid or Medicare, and for obviously the 65 and over, Medicare would be the primary, and for anyone that is Medicaid eligible, that eligibility needs to be performed prior to us being able to collect, so they would have to be deemed eligible.
So did I just hear you say that you can get reimbursements on the Medicare end, and you're going to in 2014 be able to do that on Medicaid?
Mr. Chairman, Medicare and Medicaid would come on board at the same time, January of 2014, under health care reform.
All right, then for the folks with, you know, tough or bad medical situations, do you have the providers come into the facility?
Mr. Chairman, we can, you know, we do what we can with our medical staff. We handle the cases we can. If it's a case that we simply, you know, is beyond our control that we cannot handle in the institution, we do take them to a community provider under contract with DOC.
Yeah, I assume that they're, particularly with the violent population, maybe even the property crimes folks, there gets to be a point where they are physically incapable of repeating their crimes, and warehousing them in your facility in the last 30 months as they, you know, go down a downward trajectory path to death. Is there any provision where we can let those people who are not physical threats out of the facility, you know, into something far less expensive and stuff?
Mr. Chairman, I think at this point what we're pushing up against is medical parole, and that would be under Mr. Taylor's, and he can explain medical parole procedures.
Yeah. Any other questions for Leslie?
Well, I guess I'll reiterate my substance abuse question pertaining particularly to prescription drugs. You know, it sounds like you don't have any data on that, but how do you manage an addicted individual?
Through the chair to Senator Diesel. When someone is in the booking process and they're brought into a facility, if it is determined by our medical staff that this individual's, you know, life truly is in risk through the detox process, they will be taken to a hospital. We will be able to handle anything that we deem that, you know, we can handle through a step-down drug process, you know, is handled by our medical staff. Otherwise, we would seek outside care because we do not want to run the risk of someone dying in the facility when they're detoxing.
Well, then I assume you have to provide a level of security so that they don't fake their problems and split on you and it perhaps hurt somebody in their exit. Isn't that very expensive?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is, and having security does add another layer of expense to this equation.
Yeah, so are there other places in the country where you have a secure wing within your prison and provide those services there? So,
Mr. Chairman, yes, you're right. In most of the lower 48, there are what they call special needs prisons, and that is a prison that is specifically and usually centrally located to, you know, medical community and medical services. And it is for, you know, end-of-life inmates, those with chronic health issues. But we don't have that.
Yeah. Well, I trust you will move that direction when you're able and when it's appropriate. Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Geisel?
Well, yes, kind of follow up on that. You know, maybe I have a misunderstanding, but what I understood was that a person is not taken into custody until those medical needs are taken care of, because that helps push those costs away from our prison system, that actually the private sector has to cover those expenses, the hospital providing charity care or whatever. When the person is released, then you take custody and then begin incurring costs. Am I confused about that?
Through the chair to Senator Geisel, that is not typically the case. If, you know, depending, of course, on the crime, you know, at times you're right. You know, if it was a very low-level, low-risk crime, that could occur. But for the most part, they come through the door and we pick up the health care cost.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure that's part of the judgment there, is how much danger of escape or reoffending for that person. Senator Coghill, any question? All right, let's move on. We have another half hour, so.
Would you like
please.
The commissioner to come back up then?
Yeah, but thank you. That really helps clarify my question the other day.
So, Mr. Chair, when we began at probation and parole looking at not just our risk, but the other piece of it that we're starting to turn our attention to is our high probation violation rates. We saw back in 2002 our jail admissions for probation violations increased from 1,600 to over 2,700. Now, in the last year, one of the things that we've seen is that there's been a slight decrease, or at least pretty consistent with that number of 2737. So for us, we're starting to do something. We know we need to do more, but at least we're starting to stop the growth from the way it's been in the past decade. Our caseloads for probation has increased over 20% during that time. And in 2011, more than 50% of our probationers had some sort of petition to revoke probation filed. And as you can see from the chart, most of those violations were for technical violations, as you mentioned earlier, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Just on that, so I see some of them were misdemeanor reoffense and some were felony reoffense. That's the way I understand that pie chart.
Through the chair, yes, sir, Senator Coghill. And then the both, they were both felony misdemeanor or both legal violations as well as technical violations.
So then the technical violation, do they fall primarily into misdemeanors? Do they fall into felony? The people who are on probation, are they, help me understand that universe a little better.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, the technical violations don't involve any new criminal behavior. It's just technical behavior such as missed appointments, failure to do a UA or testing positive on a UA, failure to follow through with their treatment requirements, or not residing in the residence or not appearing to the probation offices to see the probation officer.
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons I'm asking a question is in one other study I heard that the recidivism rate was higher in misdemeanors, and I'm just kind of trying to get a mental picture of your probation violations that are technical. Do they fall more into the misdemeanors? Do they track the same category, or how do they look?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, trying to compare the misdemeanor recidivism versus the felony recidivism, you shouldn't do that. In terms of with felons, we've got different requirements, different conditions that we have to supervise. With the misdemeanor population, they're on informal supervision if they're given that. I know that there's an ASAP program that they're required to do a substance abuse education or treatment, but that would be the only requirement.
Okay. I think maybe you're misunderstanding Senator Coghill's question. He wants to know, of the present prisoner population that are going to probation, are the folks that are misdemeanors more likely to have technical violations, or it is a felony? He's not asking about their reoffense or even the level of probation. He's asking about which of those two populations messes up the most.
Through the chair, I think there is a study that shows that the misdemeanor population is probably recidivating at a higher rate.
Mr. Chairman, may I might be hearing the question wrong. These are, you supervise felons, right? Misdemeanors are informal, and your probation officers do not supervise misdemeanors. The only misdemeanors we supervise are the DV program in Fairbanks we were talking about.
And that's what I wanted to know, if any of this population was misdemeanors, because I'm trying to figure what the probation world looks like over against the recidivism. And so thank you. That was very clear. That got to the point. Thank you.
I apologize.
Joe.
What type of programs are we putting people through, and at least what are some of our results that we're beginning to see? On page 16, you'll see that we have placed people in our outpatient program, which is our LSAT program, and our RSAT program.
Once again,
I'm sorry.
Explain an acronym.
Life Success Skills, I can't remember the A, alcohol treatment, sorry, and the residential substance abuse treatment. So it's life skills, substance abuse treatment.
Thank you.
And for the that LSAT program, we've got just over half of those persons who've participated completing that program. Fairly high number of our RSAT participants are completing the program, and then we have persons who are entered into the aftercare program out in the community. Now, what we're beginning to see is that over 2.5 years now, we're looking at our substance abuse programs. Those who have participated or completed the program, their recidivism rate is 14% lower than our control group. So we are seeing some pretty good successes for our substance abuse program, and this is above our national average of 9 to 12%. So we're quite pleased with that. In terms of our education program, you see the adult basic education and GED programs that we're serving. And as the commissioner talked about earlier, our vocational education programs have been expanded considerably, and we have quite a few people participating in those programs. One of the things that we have not had the opportunity to measure the effectiveness of those programs yet. It's just in the infancy, and as the commissioner talked about, our grading and our auditing and performance management, we're starting to take a look at those programs as well, and hopefully within the next year or so be able to bring some data back to the committee so that you can see how we're doing with these programs. And then last but not least, our faith-based programs.
Right, skipping ahead on page 26, I see an amazing list of training programs, I think, that you're hoping to have. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And when we get there, I'll explain what we've got.
We may not get there.
Oh.
Do it.
Do you want to get there now, sir?
Well, just explain to me where you're at and what it's going to take to get there and when.
Okay. Actually, on page 26, and I'll go there with the slide real quick. What you're actually seeing is the 25, I should start with, is the Goose Creek.
Yes, sir.
And what we're doing to ramp up our Goose Creek program.
Yes.
The blue are the current programs that we have in place at Goose Creek. The black are the ones that will be coming on between the end of this fiscal year and next fiscal year. So starting with page 25, for example, the RSAT program is not yet in place in Goose Creek, but by the end of the fiscal year, beginning of next fiscal year, we will transfer the RSAT program from Hudson, Colorado to Goose Creek facility. We do have some educational services, as you can see there. And if you turn on the next page to 26, our vocational services. The blue, again, are programs that we currently have in work, such as the Safe Food Handler and Seafood Worker Card, our computer training. We've been working with the Department of Labor for their Key Training and Work Keys program, which is their skill building programs that they have through the Department of Labor, and an intro to welding course that we have through NESR. That's a certification program.
Yeah, just parenthetically, Ron, it takes quite a bit of equipment to do some of this. You know, how in the world do you train people in safe food handling or seafood working without the food and the seafood?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, without the food. You can't train them without the food, so you, they have to have the food and the seafood. I think it goes all the way back to how we classify people and to make sure that those persons who are programming and those persons who are of adequate risk, we're putting in these, are allowing to go into these type of programs, sir.
Does that mean go off campus to work in a food process or a fish plant in Seward?
No, sir. Not at least not at the moment.
Yes.
That may be something that we look at in the future in terms of our Kenai program.
Yeah, so then how do you get the food in there and what happens to the food? Do they feed the food to the prisoners out of the food handler training?
That's correct, sir.
All right. And I think the McKinley plant's gone away, hasn't it?
No, sir. It's still there, Mr. Chairman. How many people do we send every day?
15.
15 people a day go there from Palmer, and they work the meat plant. And we get a call once in a while because we slack off a little bit and they don't have enough, so we amp it back up again.
Is it still in the same old building?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And so it provides some slaughtering services for ranchers and dairy people in the area. It still does some wild game?
I don't know if it does wild game. Do we know that? I'd have to get back. I don't know if it does.
All right.
Still do wild game. There's a big separation. I know there's a time when they did it, but it was in a different day after a cleaning process and all that, but I don't know if it's still.
It's a little bit, serves the community need, serves the training fund. And do you have any tracking on how people you train there, what their job rate getting jobs is like?
I don't think so.
No, sir, Mr. Chair. In fact, that's what I was talking about in terms of being able to put the grading and auditing piece of that program in for vocational services.
Thank you. Same kind of issues with the building trades. These guys actually build something useful. And what do you do with that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Oh, well, we have a great big room, and we build a little house in there, and we take it apart and build it again. All the plumbing, all the electric, and our instructors, it's just a small version of a house with shingles and insulation and pipes and wires and all those things, and it's in a shop, and then they disassemble it, and they use it, buy a few materials and build it again with the next class.
Is there any interaction with you all's training programs and traditional vocational training and or apprenticeships?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is. In fact, Department of Labor works very well with us to develop these programs and certifications.
All right. As we wind down here, I want committee members to particularly get a chance to ask any questions, general or specific. All right. Please continue, Ron.
Do you want me to go back, or because I can?
Let's do the electronic monitoring.
Okay.
And hit the delta, the difference between passive and active, and the difference in what it provides and what it costs, please.
Mr. Chair, let's go back to the passive versus active. The GPS system. The other day when I was before you in a different committee, I spoke that the department had passive GPS. That's when we use the GPS system, it's a passive system. Most of our system is not the passive GPS, but it's what's called a, since you don't like acronyms, let me get it right for you, transdermal alcohol unit. So it's a TAD unit that we use. And that's to test for alcohol for that person, as well as just to curfew checks to make sure that the person is where they're supposed to be. So that's the primary tool that we use for our electronic monitoring.
Senator Coghill?
So that unit is like you a telephone, or is it like a blow unit in a car?
That's the one through the chair, Senator Coghill, that we use through the telephone. I think that I got a look from Senator Dyson the other day that he was a little confused on that, and so I wanted to make sure I clarified that. But the active and passive GPS system, active is you get to look at them on a screen. You've got somebody watching it 24/7 and able to respond on a 24/7 basis. The passive is you don't have a person watching that, but you can download that information through a GPS locator and be able to review that the next day, either in our electronic monitoring office or through our company that we use our contract with.
So, but that only tells you whatever that person was doing, where their phone was?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It tells you where the person is in a GPS system, but not necessarily what the person is doing.
Tells you where that person is when they do their thing with that phone. Only, Senator Coghill.
I was understood that it was like an ankle bracelet that was a GPS unit that you did that. But is it their phone?
The TAD unit is a bracelet itself. The GPS can go through the cell phone as part of what Senator Dyson is. But we'll be more than happy to provide you with the additional information on that.
So then what's the active one?
Again, we'll be more than happy to get that information for you so that you actually see that. We're doing a whole presentation on electronic monitoring that we're working to put together now. So,
I think you do know what the difference is, but we're not communicating.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think that we might be missing the question. Active is knowing where they are in real time. Is it fair to say?
That's fair.
I mean, we can see where they are at any given time. And passive, it's a download situation, and Ron's more up on this than I am, but it downloads once a day or whatever prescribed
time.
So we can go back and say, well, you shouldn't have been here. And there is obviously complications with, once I know where this person is, there's going to be an expectation that I'd be able to get there and do something before something happens. And so there's a monitoring complication, and there's a response, I don't want to say cost, but complication. There's, what would we be expected to do? I guess the technology is here to do a lot of this stuff. We have chosen to do the passive because of, the type of people we're putting out there, the way we're supervising them, the cost, of course. And we believe that we can keep that offender, to keep the public safe from that offender with our passive system that downloads at a given interval. And we can keep close enough to them to go get them before something happens, we believe, in most cases. The program's running at more than 90% successful right now, meaning more than 90% finish the program and go on with life without any issues. The 10% that come back, I think you can count on one hand how many had new crimes. The rest were technical, we violation type activity. So we don't mean to try to dodge the question, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't mean to.
No.
You're right. We were miscommunicating. So a few years ago, we were talking to you about doing this with pretrial folks, and I think you've moved some in that direction. Would you comment on that, sir?
We have. Can you BI, right, Ron?
Sure. Correct.
Go ahead.
Well, we have done a few of the pretrial, but mostly ours are our sentenced person that we're putting on electronic monitoring. I don't know the actual numbers that are pretrial versus actual sentence. I know that we have at least tripled our capacity in terms of electronic monitoring over the past, since the commissioner came into office, and we're serving about 329 persons right now in electronic monitoring.
Yeah, and as I remember, on some circumstances, perpetrator would be pretrial, the accused is paying some of that cost. Is that correct?
That is correct. The cost is about $35 a day, Mr. Chairman, total, and the offender will pay something in the neighborhood of $14 a day. Leslie, if she's panicking behind me, please let me know. But it's about that. So it's by far the cheapest thing we do, and what we would probably talk through as we develop this program and as it takes new life and new forms of its use is just making sure everyone knows it's very effective and it's very cheap, and it will become less cheap obviously as we add complexity to it. We're capable of a whole bunch of things, but I feel like we're struggling a little bit on this issue. Billy Hauser is our guy that runs the EM program and knows every detail of it, and someday if there's an interest at a hearing or a meeting or whatever it would be, we'd be happy to come in and
And as I remember, judges have sometimes said, and I forget what part of the process, you got to stay out of this neighborhood.
Yep.
You can't go near here.
Right.
Schools or somebody that had been assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to take electronic monitoring. If it does, then does alarm go off somewhere if they get to go to where they're not supposed to go?
Ron?
Mr. Chair, I believe it does, and that's through our contractor that we get the reports from in terms of when they were out of area. We'll get an alert from the company.
I remember being with one of my foster kids in a grocery store, walked right around the corner and into the perp you know.
Oh.
Inordinately stressful. But that's beyond your purview. Please continue.
I think, Mr. Chair, you wanted to know about some costs, and I believe that
yes, sir.
Leslie would have the cost information, sir.
Okay.
Thank you. We do have costs.
Identify yourself again for the record, please.
No problem. Leslie Houston, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Corrections. For our costs is the alcohol device, as Mr. Taylor was speaking to. There's two types, and the individual on electronic monitoring, if they chose to do it through a cell phone, that would cost them roughly $234 a month. If they were to do it versus a hard line, which is required for some, then it would be $182 a month. Now going to a GPS system, if it were to be an active system, they would be looking at $330 a month. If it were a passive system, they'd be looking at $165. And it's worth noting that, you know, as mentioned here, the majority of our folks on EM do have the alcohol device. If we were to also require an active GPS system, they would have to wear two devices. The alcohol detection system does not have an active GPS function. So it would also double the cost.
Leslie, Ron, or Commissioner, I suspect that some folks that have been jurisdiction have been doing this for quite a while can demonstrate that spending this amount of money for these kind of things saves a significant amount of money downstream. Is there any of that data available?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. We could, of course, provide a report, but anecdotally, we've got 330-some inmates on electronic monitoring right now. That's a prison facility. I mean, there's prison facilities with less beds than that if it wasn't for the, I mean, if they had to sit in a jail bed, that's where they would be. And the program was close to 200 when I first came in, and then there were some changes to the good time statute, and good time was removed as one of the benefits of, or you can no longer subtract good time if you're on electronic monitoring. And the numbers, of course, plummeted as we expected. It's a voluntary program down into the low 100s, and so we've been working on building it back up with the statutes like they are, of course, and we're up over 300 now. So that was a measure of success for us because the program has been so successful.
I wouldn't pretend to tell you how to do your business, but I think that having those figures, that spending this amount of money results in this kind of cost avoidance, you know,
got
if
it.
You will, and the need for more beds sooner and all that
got it.
Would be useful, but
sure.
That's your business. Any other questions? Please continue.
And just to follow up on what this discussion is going is, a good example would be our current daily cost of care for a hard bed at an institution is $147.21. Now, when you take the EM cost for the offender, and then you add the extra state cost for the oversight, you know, we're looking at $50 a day. So that's a good way to look at it.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Please continue, Rob.
Mr. Chair, if you just wanted the electronic monitoring stuff, that's all we have to present on the information, and so I would be done now.
I talked a little bit about PACE earlier. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Commissioner, that we need to know?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I think I overviewed the concept was, you know, hit them, I won't say hit them hard, but don't tolerate any of that little stuff. And it sure messages well because everybody understands, you know, you're not going to tolerate any of that funny business. At the end of the day, we see less jail days, almost half as many jail days with the same group. And we can't predict what people would have done, but we look at what they have done and what they're doing with this PACE model, and we're seeing less jail days. So we came forward with a new concept, a new program, and we didn't say, hey, we have this program, you know, that's going to result in people being in jail less. That's not, you know, that's the end result, but really what we're doing is we're getting their attention, certainty of getting caught, and that seems to be the thing that works. So
yeah, I've sat in on several of the therapeutic trials,
uh-huh.
both the Stephanies, which is kind of a precursor to the
yep.
An acronym PACE, and mm-hmm. That's tough love in action. I'm impressed.
You need any information on the reentry task force, Mr. Chair? I can go through that real quickly.
Yeah, give us a typical story of what are the options that are available to a prisoner that's walking out of the door. You don't just give them $20 and say, have a happy life.
No, sir. It really is based on the their need and what we need to do in terms of substance abuse, employment, and housing. And so some of those reentry options are in alignment with the housing, such as temporary rental vouchers that they can get through some of our Partners for Progress and Alaska Housing. The one thing I will highlight is that as part of the reentry task force, we have several reentry coalitions in different communities. That for us is where the real success can be gathered in terms of these reentry coalitions.
But a few of those are nonprofit volunteer programs.
We have all of volunteer programs, actually, and that what you have is people coming together and looking at the resources that are there to see where the gaps are in that local community. And for us, that's where we're going to really begin to identify how we can improve on those persons returning to those communities, given the resources that they have there.
And as I remember, AA is free to operate in most of your facilities. And they have a follow-up step. Isn't Narcotics Anonymous also active in our state?
Yes, sir, it is, Mr. Chair.
All right, we're about out of time. Any questions, comments? I appreciate you letting me kind of divert you off track, but I think we've hit some very significant issues, and I'm impressed. Anything else you need to tell us, Commissioner?
Well, when I come back, I know that each of you believes strongly in these principles and cares about these issues just like we do. We're honored to be part of the discussion, to be able to come in and speak to you. I think the rate at which I'm speaking will be something that most would consider normal next time. If there's not a little bit of nerves coming in here, you probably don't deserve to be here. So, anyway, that's all I have, sir.
Make you nervous. Senate State Affairs is adjourned at 10:28.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.